Hello, everyone, and welcome to this new series, the Ardoranyé, the Kingdom of Arda in the Elvish Quenya, the Vice Regency of Manwë on Arda. Or alternatively, this can be called the Matter of Middle Earth or the Matter of Arda. And this is going to be a history podcast series concerning the history of J.R.R. Tolkien's Middle Earth, the setting of The Lord of the Rings, not to be confused as a reading or an overview of the 12-volume History of Middle-earth edited by Christopher Tolkien. By history, I do not mean a strict account of the lore or an overview of what I'm sure some of you may be thinking derisively as a purely fictional history of a fantasy setting. There are plenty of channels that already do that. I mean, an overabundance of channels, if anything. I mean this to be a real history. But what do I mean by this? Yes, there will be an extensive chronological account and analysis of the lore of the Silmarillion, from the Ainur Lindale to the Fourth Age. I'll get to what that means in a moment. On my channel, you'll notice that I've dedicated a lot of work to the idea of polity, meaning peoples, their political, cultural, and social structures and roots, and how these polities have manifested and evolved. I mean to treat the world of the Silmarillion, the world of Arda, in a similar fashion. However, in addition to referencing the history of the construction of the Silmarillion, this series will serve as a literary, mythological, and yes, historical critique of Tolkien's legendarium. So at once it is going to be a lore series, and at the same time it is going to be a legendarium historicity series, and plausibly have some sort of basis in a historical reality. As for how I'm going to go about this being the first episode, this title episode is titled On the Silmarillion, A Mythology for England, which will be both an introduction to the series and, in this reading lecture, a delineation of the purpose of Tolkien's creation. And hopefully, after this, you'll understand how one can feasibly treat the subject as real history, which will inform us as we go forward. It should also be noted that in the description, I have many academic articles which you can prepare, which you could read at your own leisure. They'll definitely form the basis of the discussion we're going to have at the same time next week. And the fact that there are so many peer-reviewed essays, works on this topic, and books, I think should indicate that this is indeed a proper bona fide subject, which, again, there is a whole dedicated academic subdiscipline to it, Tolkien studies. If you'll permit me an allusion to Tolkien's work, this series will not proceed according to some grand design from the outset. I've abandoned formal scripted videos on my channel for the time being, and it will instead be reverting to either a loose lecture format where I'll be mulling over the subject as I speak, or I will deliver multiple readings, a single reading, or some combination thereof. You can expect this type of format in varying degrees from any future episodes dubbed lecture. I want to emphasize as well that this is very much a collaborative process. If you have any questions or super chats, I will answer them to the best of my ability at the end. Moreover, next week, and then every fortnight, there will be a discussion episode, further developing any points made and potentially bring up new ones as per this lecture reading. You can expect Mr. Patriarch on those episodes, and possibly Nathan Hood, and we'll see about other guests as well. Now, relaying this back to what is meant by the Silmarillion or the Legendarium, this is important because it'll provide the bedrock for the series and what you can expect to be discussed, and possibly act as a guide for what you can read for yourselves in your own spare time. Now, when organizing this stream, I had intended for a loose format, referencing some of the articles I've listed in the description and quoting from Tolkien's letters. The best way to access Tolkien's letters, by the way, is Humphrey Carpenter's book compilation. Humphrey Carpenter, it must also be emphasized, is the preeminent biographer of Tolkien, if you don't already have his biography of Tolkien. However, when rummaging through various potential sources for this evening, I realized I already possessed a fantastic essay by Charles E. Knode and edited by Carl Hostetter, who has just produced the so-called 13th edition of The History of Middle-earth, The Nature of Middle-earth, and Verlin Flieger, who is also listed in the description below, on the construction of the Silmarillion. This essay succinctly accomplishes the tasks I had already set out for this stream, in that it both delineates the development and purpose of the Silmarillion, whilst engaging with the notion of Tolkien's mythology for England. Put it bluntly, it is of more value to listeners than anything I could produce under my current rather severe time constraints. It also happens that this essay is quite difficult to access, unless you possess a copy of the rather prohibitively expensive Tolkien's Legendarium, Essays on the History of Middle-earth, unless you can somehow acquire a copy or borrow it. I will add that anyone wants a very succinct overview, introduction to the Silmarillion, you can't do better than Letter 131 in Competence Collection, the Waldmund letter, which is prefaced to the beginning of the Silmarillion. And of course, it should be mentioned that that is a letter by Tolkien to Waldmund. Just a further note going forward, regarding examining the nature and mythology of England, you may note I've emphasized the Silmarillion aspect on this particular lecture, because this is going to be an introduction to what the Silmarillion is and what you can expect going forward. When it comes to actually examining the nature of the Middle-earth matter as a stand-in for a mythology of England, I'm very much hoping that this will set up many of the questions in this essay and will then lead into that conversation next Friday. So without further ado, here's the reading. It should also be mentioned that this is a bridge because if you see in the description, it is 39 pages long. The Silmarillion, the saga of the three great jewels, wrought by Fëanor in ancient time, the epic of the first age of the world, the mighty matter of the elder days, was the main current of J.R.R. Tolkien's creative endeavour during a long life. He began it as a young man during the Great War and was still working on it, leaving it an incomplete and, as we know, fairly incoherent state when he died. The Silmarillion, published in 1977, consisted of two shorter preliminary pieces, the Ainul Lindale and the Valar Quenta, followed by the Quenta Silmarillion, or the Silmarillion proper, as its editor Christopher Tolkien termed it, ending with two independent pieces, the Acabala, and also, as I go on, there are going to be a lot of Tolkien words used here, and do forgive my pronunciation if I do get them wrong. There are also a couple of Finnish words in here as well. Akalabet, of the and of the Rings of Power, and the Third Age, and of course, anyone knows that that is the new title which has been announced for the Amazon Lord of the Rings series. Now, the Quenta is indeed the Silmarillion proper, and in the published version, it was made to carry the whole burden of the narrative. But even as in his foreword, Christopher Tolkien indicated an underlying textual complexity at which the published version did not hint. The same legends come to be retold in longer and shorter forms, and in different styles. My father came to conceive the Silmarillion as a compilation, a compendious narrative made long afterwards from the sources of great diversity, poems, annals, and oral tales, that has survived an age-long tradition. And this conception has indeed its parallel in the actual history of the book, for a great deal of earlier prose and poetry does underlie it, and it is to some extent a compendium in fact, and not only in theory. Elsewhere he observed that by the time of his father's death, the huge quantity of material on the three ages varied in content, from heroic verse in the ancient English alliterative meter to severe historical analysis of his own extremely difficult languages, a vast repository and labyrinth of story, of poetry, of philosophy, and of philology. The decision to produce a version edited into a single, finished narrative form, rather than the bulky scholarly volume tracing the detailed evolution of the work that had been considered, resulted in the Quenta Silmarillion, carrying the major textual burden, with no other complexities being allowed to surface. With the publication of Unfinished Tales, readers got an inkling of the complexity of the constituent writings, an appreciation deepened by the history of Middle-earth, which explored their evolution in unprecedented detail. That appreciation has prompted the present inquiry. So much of the revealed material consists not just of earlier abandoned versions of already known Silmarillion material, but of writings, some in a finished state, many not, that are of the greatest interest in understanding Tolkien's creation. These are not simply straightforward narratives of various kinds, but take the form of distinct texts, presented as the works of ancient authors or compilers, concerning even older historical or legendary matter, usually given titles of their own to reflect the status. Perhaps the main reason behind this kind of approach to literary creativity lies in Tolkien's professional concern with real texts, for instance, Beowulf, Sir Gawain, and Pearl. He was concerned not simply to produce tales and narratives in themselves, but to produce the distinctive texts that contain those narratives and chronicles, texts that are in themselves historical artifacts. He may have never finished the Silmarillion because he judged the texts of which it was composed with some scholarly discipline he brought to real texts and found himself a stern judge, one very hard to please. The principal fictional works that he managed to finish and publish in his lifetime, The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, were not themselves conceived as texts per se. They were simply narratives. Their author free of the constraints that producing texts seemed to impose. That they were explained as being based on the extracts from the Red Book of Westmarch does not detract from that interpretation. The point is that to Tolkien, the nature of the Silmarillion was highly distinctive, an assemblage of texts, each with its own history and provenance, and by implication, a relationship between the world in which it is a text and the world of which the text itself speaks. A major element of the problem of what might have been produced had Tolkien completed the Silmarillion to his satisfaction lies in the question of what textual units the book as a whole would have comprised. A finished Silmarillion would contain the Aina Lindale, the Valar Quenta, and the Quenta Silmarillion itself. What of those other texts that either split off from the Quenta or grew independently, such as the Lay of the Children of Hurin, the Lay of Lethian, the Ambar Katana, the Annals of Valinor and Beleriand in their various forms, the Ar-Trabeth, the unfinished revision of the Fall of Gondolin, and the Narn, with the rest of the Turin Turambar material. On November the 25th, 1911, Ronald Tolkien, then a first-year undergraduate at Oxford University, signed out C.N.E. Eliot's A Finnish Grammar from Exeter College Library. This had profound consequences in that it enabled him to read the Finnish national epic, the Kalevala, in its original language, leading him to a deeper appreciation of the linkages between language and mythology. And this reading engendered the desire for something similar to the Kalevala for England. Having first encountered the Kalevala in English, he wanted to be able to read it in its original language, but even in English it affected him. I was immensely attracted by something in the air of the Kalevala, even in Kirby's poor translation. The Finnish grammar enabled him to get something of the linguistic feel of the work. Primarily, it impressed him as the expression of a national mythology. These mythological ballads are full of that very primitive undergrowth that the literature of Europe has, on the whole, been steadily cutting and reducing for many centuries. He told a college society at the time, adding, "I would that we had more of it left, something of the same sort that belonged to the English." He was much taken with the language itself. "It quite intoxicated me," he recalled later, "and I gave up the attempt to invent an unrecorded Germanic language, and my own language, or series of invented languages, became heavily Finnicized in phonetic pattern structure." Reading the Kalevala in Finnish helped focus Tolkien's mind on myth per se, but especially with reference to the mythologies of Europe. Given the intoxication he felt with the original, he may have reflected on how it was such mythological undergrowth was so aptly expressed in its native language, as though the aesthetic of the one meshed with the other. Finnish provided a glimpse of an entirely different mythological world. Another effect of reading the Kalevala was to show how linguistics and mythology ran together, although it was not until some 2 years had passed that Tolkien came to fully understand the connection. It was just as the 1914 war burst upon me that I made the discovery that legends depend on the language to which they belong, but a living language depends equally on the legends which it conveys by tradition. So though being a philologist by nature and trade, I began with language. I found myself involved in inventing legends of the same taste. Language and legend, then, had occupied much of his imaginative and intellectual landscapes of childhood and early youth. As he remarked in his 1951 account of his mythology for Milton Waldman, "Many children make up or begin to make up imaginary languages. I have been at it since I could write. But an equally basic passion of mine, ab initio, was for myth, not allegory, and for fairy story, and above all for heroic legend, on the brink of fairy tale and history. Still later, he recalled, I began the construction of languages in early boyhood, but I was also interested in traditional tales, especially those concerning dragons. Tolkien's involvement with fairy tales again goes back to childhood. The first great impression made on him was the Grimm's The Juniper Tree, whose beauty and horror remained with him throughout his life, yet whose chief flavour was one of distance and a great abyss of time. His attempt to write a story involving a great green dragon took place about the age of 7, when he started to compose one based on the tale of Sigurd and the dragon Fafnir. He didn't continue with it, and wrote no more such tales for many years, but he desired dragons with a profound desire. At King Edward's school, he came into contact with Beowulf, Pearl, and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight in their original tongues, and in his last year at school, he encountered the Kalevala. The immediate consequences were twofold. He abandoned his Neo-Gothic for an invented language that had much more to do with Finnish. He began an attempt to turn one of the stories of the Kalevala, the tale of Kullervo, Kullervo, into a short story somewhat on the lines of William Morris's romances, with chunks of poetry in between. The dating of this exercise is unclear. He later thought he began in the Honor Mods period, since his Honor Moderations began at the end of February 1913. His belief that the period when he started his piece writing was around 1912 to 1913 is borne out, and yet he was still working on the tale in October 1914. Plainly, this was an undertaking of some moment. He later considered that this effort was the beginning of the legendarium and the germ of my attempt to write legends on my own to fit my private languages. Insofar as the Kullervo served as the germ for Turin Turambar, this was in one sense the beginning of the legendarium, but only as a model for future works. It is not claimed that Tolkien's Kullervo itself incorporated any invented languages, although it is difficult to be certain, as no part of it has ever been published. In any case, given the time that Tolkien spent on it, it was useful practice for future work. Also at the time, he began to study the poetic and prose Eddas. Tolkien had produced several poems of various degrees of seriousness from about 1910. It is notable that it is in the poetry that we find the first datable piece of creative writing, especially about the mythology, The Shores of Faerie, written July 8th to 9th, 1915. Its earliest version began, West of the moon, east of the sun, there stands a lonely hill. The date is possibly 2 months later, when it was actually written, since he painted a picture entitled The Shores of Faerie, illustrative of the poem that he dated May 10th, 1915. In a later note, Tolkien described it as his first poem of my mythology. Up to this point, some of his poems had been about fairy folk on the like, but none was part of a structured mythology. But by now, Elendil had made his entrance. Tolkien had begun to respond with greater acuity and sensitivity to the linguistic as well as the purely imaginative aspects of the ancient English and Northern writings he encountered. In late 1913 or early 1914, he read the old English poem Crist and felt a curious thrill when he read Ala Elendil, Engler Behotast, Offer Midengert, Monum Sendet. There was something very remote and strange and beautiful behind those words, if I could grasp it, far beyond ancient English. This was Tolkien speaking in the person of Loudon in the Notion Club papers of 1945-6. He goes on to say, it may derive its curiously moving quality from some older world. Thus, it was that in September 1914, he wrote The Voyage of Elendil, the Evening Star, which began, Elendil sprang up from the ocean's cup in the gloom of the Midworld's rim. This is still not quite mythological. It reflects a structured legendarium and descriptions are general, not even mentions the ship of the moon, the haven of the sun, and the Westerland make it so. At this stage, Elendil is no part of an existing mythology. When Tolkien showed the verses to G.B. Smith, Smith asked him what they were about, to which he replied, I don't know, but I'm going to find out. Much later, he remarked that Elendil had been adopted into his mythology. The Bidding of the Minstrel about Elendil, written in the winter of 1914, does not reflect a developed mythology and seems more an exercise in lyrical expression. However, one of those sheets associated with the early workings of the poem is a rough account of Arendelle's wanderings that, in its earliest version and omitting later editions, shows some development of its history. This is mostly set in our world, with Arendelle wandering by Iceland, Greenland, and the Mediterranean or Atlantic, but also stranger places, the home of night, the spider. He escapes from the meshes of night with a few comrades, all indicating that a story was in the process of forming around him. One feels that Tolkien was groping for a synthesis of existing ideas. Call of April 1915 is a lyrical exercise, although the situation described corresponds with part of the history of the elves as later defined. A painting about this time, the Tanaqui, reflects the description of the poem. But it is the shores of the fairy that shows the first glimmerings of a structured mythology. This is not simply an exercise in lyrical beauty or a description of a vision. It references to Tanaquetil, Valinor, Eglamar, reflecting organized history and geography. Tolkien rightly called it the first poem of my mythology. Poems still to come had more to do with lyrics about fairy folk, but some also began to reflect an original mythology. Tolkien's note to the shores of Faerie continues, Valinor, 1910. Although Valinor has not been mentioned before, it must have been present in some form, if not by that name, in Tolkien's mind from 1910, the year he started to write poetry. This concept seems to have formed a distinct thread, one to which Elendil was linked at quite an early age. It was to the shores of Faerie that Tolkien attached his note referring to his thoughts on Valinor as having begun in 1910, thereby implying a linkage of a kind. Since the first piece of writing to reflect a coherent mythology, The Shores of Faerie, goes back to July or May of 1915, is it possible to date with any more accuracy the initial formulation of the invented mythology? Given that it has almost certainly did not spring fully formed from Tolkien's head, and given also that many of the relevant notes in both volumes of the Book of Lost Tales are impossible to date with much accuracy, it might be useful to ask instead, when did the idea of constructing a mythology first occur to Tolkien? In the absence of more definitive data, we must look to the meetings of the TCBS, Tolkien, Christopher Wiseman, R.Q. Gilson, and G.B. Smith, at Wiseman's family house in London in the Christmas vacation of 1914. The so-called Council of London, as Tolkien shortly after called it. In a letter to Smith of 12th of August 1916, he wrote, I cannot abandon yet the hope and ambitions that first become conscious of the Council of London. That council was, as you know, followed in my own case with my finding a voice for all kinds of pent-up things and a tremendous opening up of everything for me. It may have been at this meeting that the idea of a mythology for England became a conscious ambition, with the results that the tale of Kullervo was abandoned, if it had not been already, and the shape of a reinvented mythology became the object of immediate concern. It was a time for the drawing together of the threads that had existed in more or less isolation until then. The matter of Elendil had to be fitted in, for it was this that hinted at a real link with something very remote and strange and beautiful, far beyond ancient English. The Kalevala had provided that inspiration, but Elendil had pointed to a connection. It may be that this was a project conceived not for Tolkien only, but for the TCBS as a whole, but Smith and Gilson did not survive the Somme, and only Tolkien could take on the task subsequently. Carpenter notes that Tolkien decided after the Council of London that he was a poet. Certainly he produced a good deal of verse after 1914, but poetry as such plays a minor, though not an unimportant part of his creative oeuvre. As for language, given his understanding of the connection between language and myth, it was natural that he should seek to find a place for it, especially for its speakers, in the invented mythology. Thus, the first half of 1915 saw a coalescence of all the previous separate strands and the attempt to make them one consistent whole. The problem was not just one of content. There was the form in which it should be presented. Since the material was mythical and legendary, it had to be presented in something like the form that such material usually takes, and Tolkien was by now familiar with such things, the Kalevala, the Poetic Edda, The Prose Edda, Beowulf, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, Pearl, the Volsung Saga, and so on. These have survived more or less intact from antiquity, or else incorporated ancient material, even if only relatively recent compiled. The Kalevala, I believe, was compiled in 1835. But it is not just their antiquity that distinguishes them, but their literary and poetic character. Tolkien's mythology had to reflect this, the form of ancient epic transmitted over long periods of time. This typically involves a fixed text transmitted through time by being repeatedly copied, and it was as such a text or texts that Tolkien wanted to present his mythology. He had been writing the tale of Kulevo in a mixed prose and poetry style influenced by William Morris. The form chosen for the mythology bore some remnants to Morris's The Earthly Paradise, wherein a party of sailors, having sailed the seas for long years, at last find harbour in a new land where they are told various myths and legends. This is all in verse, whereas Tolkien was to write in prose. The initial form taken by the mythology involved the 5th century mariner, Ariel, sailing west from Middle-earth of the Danish peninsula, the original home of the English, to the elvish isle of Tol Alesia, the lonely mountain, which has various allusions to Avalon in The Matter of Britain, and more so if you factor in that Tolkien later disconnected Tol Alesia from Britain and made them different places. There he has told tales of its fairy inhabitants. He writes them all under the general title of the Book of Lost Tales, which can be regarded as another Old English text. Conceivably, Tolkien contemplated producing a version in Old English once it was completed, but that is to go ahead of ourselves. At some period following the Council of London, he was in the position to have a good idea of both the form and the content of his invented mythology. The Book of Lost Tales was not written in sequential order. Rather, the individual lost tales told to Ariel were put on paper to the extent that Tolkien had them established in his mind and could bring them to coherent form. The first was The Fall of Gondolin, sometime in late 1916. Notably, it is the final parts of the Book of Lost Tales that appear to have caused the most difficulties, and that remained in the form of notes and outlines without achieving the stature of tales told. These dealt with the fates of Elendil and Ariel. The tale of Elendil never became a finished prose piece, and the fate of Ariel and his book is bound up with the problem of closure, how the events of the mythology are resolved, how the mythology itself evolves into history, and how it is transmitted to the latter history by its original writer. The most definitive form of this letter, setting out the concerns, is the outline in which Christopher Tolkien terms Notebook C. But an outline it remained. We shall continue to see how these problems are treated in subsequent texts. Since the title assigned to a text reveals its author's intention, we may note that the most complete title of this collection was The Golden Book, being the Book of the Tales of Tavriel. Here, Hellonda is the son of Ariel, but since Tolkien eventually decided that Ariel survived, after all, to complete his book, we may as well substitute his name in the title. Tavriel is the Great Heywood, since at this stage Tol Alesia eventually becomes the island of Britain after it is dragged back to the great lands for the faring forth. Thus the mythology stood, uncompleted at some time in the early 1920s, with Britain occupying a central place in it. Concurrently with the Book of Lost Tales, Tolkien continued to work on his two major invented languages, and he had gone so far as to compose lexicons for them. That for Quenya had begun in 1915, that for Goldegrin or Gnomish in 1917. These two appear to have at some stage been considered to be texts composed by Ariel, as the title page at least of the latter attributes it to him. The Gnomish grammar was apparently the work of either Rúlmil the Sage of Tol Alesia or of Ariel. Although it may be difficult to imagine that he thought these lexicons would find a ready public, they should still be accounted among the texts of the period relating to the mythology, since they come within the framing device of the Lost Tales, i.e. a retelling by Ariel of elvish material, or even such material in direct translation. In this earliest form of the mythology, Tol Alesia has yet to be drawn back to the great lands for the faring forth of the elves of Tol Alesia. to rescue the elves of the great lands. But when this does happen, the Enterprise ends in disaster, and the elves retire to Tol Eressëa, which becomes the island of Britain. In about 1926, Tolkien undertook a major revision of the framing device. Eriol had been a man of the 5th century, but Notebook C has indicated that many ages were to pass before Tol Eressëa was drawn back to the great lands for the faring forth. Due perhaps to a desire to have a more coherent time scheme, Eriol, now called Elfwine, becomes a man of the 11th century Wessex who sails west from Britain to Tol Eressëa, where he hears the tales of the elves. The faring forth is now the original march of the elves of Cor to the great lands, rather than the drawing of Tol Eressëa back east. In the revision, the elves from the great lands take refuge in Lutany, Britain, and there is a friendship between the elves and the invading Ingvivar, the collective name for the Angles, Saxon, Jutes, and the Frisians. However, as with the previous invasions of Lutany, many elves sail west to Tol Eressëa, and those who knew the language of the Ingvivar could speak to Elfwine in his own tongue. Even so, the term faring forth still has a prophetic meaning for the time when the elves will reoccupy Lutany and replant there the magical trees. Also introduced is the matter of Ingwe. At the first, the king of Lutany, which is still connected to the mainland, he meets the retreating elves and later Elendil, either of whom allows him to become immortal by giving him Lempe to drink. Ingve departs Lutany for the west, after which the remaining elves cut a channel to separate Lutany from the great lands, but is shipwrecked on the other side of the North Sea in the region of Denmark. He becomes the half-divine king of the Ingvivar, prophesying that they will one day go to Lutany. The scheme was never put in a finished form and is interpreted by Christopher Tolkien from disjointed notes, but it shows that Tolkien wanted to retain a connection with early English history. A coherent text, Elfwine of England, did emerge, tracing the story of Elfwine to his diving to the sea at the site of the Lonely Isle. Christopher Tolkien speculates that it may have constituted the beginning of a complete rewriting of the Lost Tales, and since the first outline goes back as far as 1920, Tolkien may have been contemplating a revision to the Eriol story for some time. This tale contains various indications of Numenor in its depiction of the island of Anandu, and a hint of the cataclysm marking the end of the Elder Days in the division of Ireland from Britain in the Warfare of the Gods. This last bit contains a hint of the difficulties Tolkien would face in trying to fit the British Isles into the scheme of things once the Lost Tales schemes were dropped. At this point, the main text is the Book of Lost Tales, left unfinished and perhaps about to be subject to massive revision of its framing device, but that soon petered out, whereas the elvish lexicons and grammars, whatever their status as texts, were part of the much more volatile subject of language. Tolkien's next major effort was to retell two of the tales in verse, the Lay of the Children of Húrin, the Lay of Lethian, which touched on the central topic of Beren and Lúthien. Húrin was begun at an early age, an early date rather, certainly before the prose Lost Tales was abandoned and continued until the summer of 1925. It is difficult to assess Húrin in terms of its status as a text, as it is written in a literative verse, meta characteristic of Old English poetry. One might imagine it to be a retelling of Elfwine by elvish matter in translation, but nothing in title or text indicates that. However, the Quenta Nordolina of 1930 carries a reference to the children of Húrin in the section dealing with Túrin's troubles as an independent text. So perhaps we can consider this text by reference, maybe a source text behind the Lost Tales account. Lithian was written about the summer of 1925 when Húrin was abandoned, and September of 1931. Again, there is no reference to Elfwine, either as author or as editor, although the earliest version of a remarkable allusion from England unto Eglamar on rock and dune and sandy bar, Tolkien returned to the poem in the early 1950s, shortly after completing The Lord of the Rings, but there is no apparent alteration in its textual status. The Quenta Nordolinwa in the section of Beren and Lúthien refers to the Lay of Lúthien and to the Lay of Lethian. So this too might be regarded as a source text, or at least a text closer to the original events of the tale. In the early 1920s, Tolkien embarked on three other poetical works connected to the mythology: The Flight of the Nol Dorli from Valinor, an alliterative poem on the departure of the elves after the destruction of the two trees, an alliterative lay of Eärendil, the lay of the fall of Gondolin in rhyming heptameters. The earliest title of the first work states that it is sung in the halls of Thingol. The second, in its mention of the Vade of the Helsings, establishes a link with an obscure figure of northern mythology, but exactly what it is impossible to say. The third is simply an attempt to retell the fall of Gondolin in verse, apparently on a compressed scale. All of these were abandoned and have no framing device that might establish them as texts in our sense, so they will not be considered further. Also, from about this time, are a few surviving prose fragments. One is titled Turlin and the Exiles of Gondolin. It would seem, as Christopher Tolkien points out, to relate closely to Fall of Gondolin, and perhaps belongs to a time when the lost tales were such still being actively considered in Tolkien's mind. I think it must also be noted as a little connection into next week's conversation that the Fall of Gondolin and the Exiles of Gondolin share many similarities with the Iliad, with the destruction of Troy, and with the story of Aeneid and the flight of the Trojans and the eventual founding of Rome. It should also be noted that when we consider the matter of Britain and forging in English mythology, one of the ancient etymologies for Britain is, of course, Brutus, not Brutus of Roman fame, but Brutus of Trojan fame. The idea that there is this link, ancient link, with Trojan exiles and the forming of England, so much so that there was even this notion that London was in reality a new city of Troy. Right. In 1926, Tolkien produced a sketch of the mythology for R.W. Reynolds, to whom he had lent the manuscript of Húrin, in order to explain the background of the poem. Although not a text in the sense we are considering, it formed the basis for the new conception of the Silmarillion that would replace the Book of Lost Tales. Changes of significance concerned the overthrow of Morgoth and the status of Britain. Now the sons of the Valar, led by Fionwë, son of Turcas, joined by all the Quendi of the Valinor, marched to the overthrow of Morgoth, who was captured and thrust through the door of night into the outer dark. In the struggle, the northern and western parts of the world are rent and broken. After this, the elves set sail from Lúthien, Britain or England, for Valinor. This implies that Britain is a remnant of the northwestern parts of the world after the last battle. There is an expansion of the prophecy of the second faring forth for the recovery of the Silmarils, the rekindling of the trees, the levelling of the mountains of Valinor, and Morgoth's death blow struck by Turin. The sometimes confusing matter of faring forth and the status of Britain has been clarified. Even so, there are still the walls of the world, implying that as in the Lost Tales, where there was the Wall of Things, we are still living in a flat world, of course, looking at the original cosmology of Tolkien. Arda, Middle Earth, begins as flat and then eventually becomes round. And of course, this is going to cause major problems for him later when he returns to the crafting of the Silmarillion after the publication of Lord of the Rings. It is not known just how Tolkien regarded this matter at the time, since his cosmology was at total variance with that of the real world, whose remote past the mythology was meant to describe. He may have given some thought to the matter, but there is no published contemporary record of it. At the end of the sketch, we learn that the tales of days before the days are still told to Ariel, who alone of mortals sailed to the Lonely Isle and back. In 1930, Tolkien created a new vehicle, the Cuenta Nordelinua, the brief history of the Nol Dorli, or gnomes, drawn from the Book of Lost Tales, which Ariel of Lithian wrote, having read the Golden Book, which the Eldar called Polma Culina in Cortritium, in Tol Alesia, the Lonely Isle. The Book of Lost Tales, which continues to exist in some manner, now comes from Ariel's reading of the Golden Book in Tol Alesia, and may be Ariel's translation of the Golden Book, and the Quenta, his further condensation of it, with a title in Elvish. The Quenta is itself a brief history of these tales. We thus have an epitome of a redaction. The status of Britain, elaborated from the sketch, is essentially the same. The northern regions of the Western world were rent and riven. there was a mighty building of ships, especially upon the great isles, which in the destruction of the northern world were fashioned of ancient Beleriand. Some elves lingered, especially in the western isles and the lands of Lethian. The British Isles are the shattered remnants of Beleriand after the last battle. As a supposed epitome of earlier texts, there are references to the accounts that stand behind the Quenta, such as the Lay of the Children of Hulin and of Lethian. The Songs of the Sun and Moon is noted, but seems to have no existence beyond that note. The Fall of Gondolin is referred to, indicating perhaps the continued existence of the old tale as a source text. The Song of Tuor that he made for his son Erendil is reproduced in an appendix as the Horns of Irma. In the writing of Quenta, the tale of Erendil begins to take its final shape. He becomes the messenger of the elves and men, and his Silmaril finds its final significance. A Lay of Erendil is referred to. With the Quenta are fragments of Ariel's translation into Old English, parts of it. This would seem to make Ariel the author of the Quenta, as well as its source, the Lost Tales. At about the same time, the Quenta Nordolinwa, Tolkien worked on the earliest versions of the Annals of Valinor and the Annals of Beleriand. These give the events and mythology, from the creation itself through to the Great Battle, as entries against a year. So establishing a consistent chronological framework, the Annals are said to be written by Pengelot, the wise of Tol Alesia. They're seen and translated by Ero of Lethin, that is, Elfwine. So these are definitely texts in our sense. Additions to the text imply that the first part of the Annals of Valinor, up to Mandos warring against Fëanor and his departing host, was written by Rumil, elf sage of Valinor. Other than the statement that Beleriand was no more at the end of the Annals of Beleriand, there is nothing to illuminate the geography. There are specimens of Ariel's translations into Old English. It may have been soon after the earliest Annals that Tolkien decided to elaborate on the cosmogonical myth of the events before the time that the Valar came into the world, beginning with their creation by Ilúvatar. This had been the first lost tale to be told, and the new text is its direct descendant. Here, the Ainur Lindale, the music of the Ainur, is described as the work of Rumil of Tún, although the work begins proper. These are the words that Rumil spoke to Elfwine. Presumably, this Rumil is the same elf sage of Valinor, responsible for the earliest part of the Annals. Despite the apparent discrepancy between some written and some being spoken to Elfwine, we may regard this as another text translated by Elfwine. Note that the original Lost Tales accounts of the music of the Ainur was told by Rumil to Eriol. This is undoubtedly a text in our sense, and by text in our sense, of course, we are referring to these ideas of a compilation, essentially, a compilation of all of these different works with different provenances in which the Silmarillion, as envisaged, is to make an essential mythology and a mythology in a pure sense. Revised forms of the Annals of Valinor and the Annals of Beleriand appeared at this time. As before, these are the works of Rumil and Pengelod. Elfwine is not mentioned, but he may be supposed still to be their translator. The only geographical information is that Beleriand was shattered and changed in the Great Battle. Right. In approximately the mid-1930s, Tolkien decided to produce an orderly description of the world in which his mythology was set. This was the Ambarkatana, the shape of the world, here ascribed to Rumil. On that basis, we may suppose it to be another text, seen and perhaps translated by Elfwine and Tol Alesia. In this miniature universe, the surface of the world lies on the upper, flat part of a hemisphere, floating in the lower half of an ellipsoid whose surface forms the Ulramba, the walls of the world. On any reasonable interpretation of scale, the ellipsoid is no bigger than the real Earth itself. And beyond the Ulramba lies not the astronomical universe, for the stars are contained inside the walls, but the void, the night without form or time. Obviously, this model universe is incompatible with the real world if it is meant to represent the remote past of that world. There may have been a nod towards incompatibility in that map 5, showing the lands after the first defeat of Morgoth, reveals a continent shaped vaguely like Africa. If it is meant to be Africa, it is far too small. If the interpretation of scale by Karen Wynne Fonstad is anything to go by, the Africa-shaped land in map 5 must be some 2,000 miles from north to south, whereas the real continent, a continent of Africa, stretches about 5,000 miles. In any case, the Ambar Katana must be considered to constitute a Silmarillion text. In perhaps 1936, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis agreed each to write a story, one on space travel, the other on time travel. After tossing a coin, Lewis sat down to write the former, Tolkien the latter. Lewis completed Out of the Silent Planet by autumn of 1936 and saw it published by the Bodley Head the following year. Tolkien embarked on the Lost Road, but never completed it. The stories of Alboin, son of Oswin Errol, who hears snatches of Arisian or Elf Latin, and Beleriandic in his in his dreams and attempts to discover their meaning. And then his own son, Alduin, has dreams that have no words or sounds, but show him scenes from a sort of phantom story. Then he steps through a door into darkness. And the next chapter brings the reader straight to the Atlantis-like island of Numenor, where Elendil and his son Helendil discuss untoward influence of Sauron upon the king. After two chapters, the story breaks off. There is a good deal of other material relating to the Northern myth and legend, alongside a kind of repeated father-son affinity, stretching backwards from Alduin and Albion all the way to Helendil and Elendil. The idea is apparently not that of a reincarnation, but of pairs of descendants having the ability to see and to hear separately. Assuming that Tolkien had the same idea when he came to write the Notion Club papers, which takes up much of the Lost Road material, what he states in the latter work can aptly can apply to the former. The theory is that the sight and memory goes on with the descendants of Elendil and Volanwë, but not reincarnation. They are different people, even if they still resemble one another in some ways after a lapse of many generations. Although the Lost Road is plainly not a Silmarillion text, it nevertheless reflects Tolkien's thought on the relation of the mythical era to history, and has something to say on Elfwine. In its associated notes, Elfwine, an Englishman of the 10th century and father of Eadwine, is said to have sailed the straight road to Eressëa, where he is told the lost tales. The straight road came in with Numenor and the world made round. At about the same time of the Lost Road, Tolkien began the last tale, The Fall of Numenor, which in successive early versions rapidly acquired its familiar shape. Whether Numenor began life as a subject matter for a time travel story was only later integrated into the mythology, or was integrated from its beginning. It was handy for a new story, adding a significant new dimension to the existing mythology. After the Great Battle and the overthrow of Morgoth, just as the elves are allowed to return to Eressëa, the men of the houses faithful to the elves are granted a new land to dwell in, raised by Ossi out of the depths of the Great Sea, and established by Aule, and enriched by Yavanna. Called out first by other names, but Numenor, by the men who came to dwell there, the realm grows in power until, inspired by the lives of Sauron, the fleet of Numenor assails Valinor itself, at which point the gods bend back the edges of Middle-earth and make it into a globe, and new lands come into being beneath the old world. Numenor is cast down, although the world is round, a straight path to the west, the same that existed in the flat world, still runs along the plains of the gods. To an observer on the ground, it would seem a straight line that climbs ever farther from the ground, but one who could sail along it would see the world drop away beneath him, as indeed happens to Elfwine in A Note to the Lost World. Looking down, Elfwine suddenly saw lands, and down in water shining in the sun, the round world is seen from the straight path. The introduction of this new material can be seen as a logical response to the shortcomings felt at least since the time of the Ambar Katana, of the myth as it had existed. It at last gets over the incompatibility between the ancient flat world and the modern globe. There is now a proper transition between them and allows an elaboration on human history in the form of an Atlantis-like realm whose destruction is part of the process of globing. The matter of Elfwine is retained by his sailing the straight path to the west. There are changes from what had gone before, apart from the fundamental change to a round world. Beleriand continues to exist, for though changed and broken, it remains a coherent entity, since it continues to have a king. Nothing is said of the Remnant Isles. Given that this work, Tol Alessia, was initially held to have drowned, it may be that here there are first signs that Tolkien was contemplating a reworking that gave up completely the framing device of Elfwine and the emergence of Britain as a remnant of the world of the mythology, even though the contemporary Lost Road still adhered to that device. Perhaps this is what Tolkien meant when he recalled that the legends of Numenor were originally unrelated and had later to be brought into the relation with main mythology. The last passage of the second version relates how Sauron, after the fall of Numenor, rebuilds his fortress in Mordor, the Black Country, a piece of history useful in plotting the Lord of the Rings. Given this understanding of the fall of Numenor, and given also the source of the work is not stated, other than being a tale of the ancient world as the elves kept it, we are probably justified in excluding it from the textual tradition as it stood at this time. The Lammas, or the account of tongues, is a description of the relationship of the languages spoken by the peoples of the mythology. It is the work of Pengelot of Tol Alessia, using the work of Rumil the sage of Tún, and was seen by Elfwine. Statements that it was very many ages since the overthrow of Morgoth and the ruin of Beleriand, and many thousand years since the fall of Gondolin, indicate that these apply to the situation at Elfwine's visit. This is a text in the main tradition. There is also the Lammasatn, Pengelod's shorter account of the Elvish tongue. At about this time, and not long before all this Silmarillion work was put aside, Tolkien composed Beleriandic and Noldorin names and words and various etymologies. This appears to have no standing as a text and may be considered as Tolkien's private notes on his invented languages, rather than as a part, however obscure, of the mythology. We now come to the Silmarillion as it stood in late 1937, before Tolkien turned to the sequel of The Hobbit. This was written on a new manuscript, distinct from the Quenta Noldorina, but later, like so many of his manuscripts, was changed in a chaotic palimpsest, with layer upon layer of correction and wholesale rewriting of riders and deletions. A typescript of the earlier chapters, including all existing emendations subtitled Silmarillion, Eldaniare, History of the Elves, was made at an early date, but this too was reduced to a shambles in the post-Lord of the Rings version. Although something of a finished work in the opening chapters, the Quenta deteriorates into a series of manuscripts representing different attempts to continue the story, but with an ending still finally reached. The first title, that of the primary manuscript, runs The Quenta Silmarillion, herein the Quenta Noldorinwa, the Penis Ingeletit, or the History of the Gnomes. A subsidiary paragraph explains that this is a history in brief from many older tales, and was composed by Pengelod of Gondolin, translated into our speech by Elfwine, who added nothing, save explanations of some few names. It contains much old matter that is still recounted in full by the Eldar of the West, but many of these were not recalled by Eriol. The last implies that Eriol did know at least some, if not all, of the old histories and songs that are epitomized in the Quenta. An initial version of the title page, to go with the typescript, shows Tolkien's intentions for the structure. Under the general heading, the Silmarillion, are listed Quenta Silmarillion, to which is appended the houses and the princes of men and elves, the tale of years, the tale of battles, the annals of Valinor, the annals of Beleriand, the tales of Lammas, or the account of tongues. The Silmarillion emerges as a general title for this material, distinct from the Quenta specifically. The announcement of the appendices to the Quenta introduces some difficulties. Genealogical tables of elves and men of this period do exist. The Tale of Years has been referred to above as having been of elvish authorship, although little is actually known of its status during this period, and nothing is known of the Tale of Battles. The impression is that these would have been brief summaries of material already existing or implied in the main texts. A further version of the title page omits the Lammas. A surviving preamble consists of a note by Elfwine, stating that the histories were originally the work of Pengelod of Gondolin, later of Tol Alessia, who used material from Rumil of Valinor in the Annals of Valinor and in the Account of Tongues, and he uses this also for the accounts that are preserved in the Golden Book. We may say that there were various ancient elvish histories, and some or all, which were collected in the Golden Book. There were also the works of Rumil, which included the original versions of the Annals of Valinor and the Lammas. From these, Pengelod made an epitome of the English of the Elvish legends in large part of the Golden Book, called the Quenta Silmarillion, and completed the Annals of Valinor and composed the Annals of Beleriand. Elfwine, having reached Tol Ressia, read and translated much of the works of Pengelod and Rumil into Old English. Since the Golden Book is associated with Tol Ressia, we might assign it to the great tales of Beleriand that the returning elves recorded. As Christopher Tolkien notes, much is missing from this unfinished version of the Quenta Silmarillion. Most of the Tale of Turin, Destruction of Doriath, the Fall of Gondolin, and the earlier part of the Tale of Orendil, but they have not been forgotten. Although it was never returned to, the Lay of the Children of Húrin still existed, and since he returned to it by the early 1950s, the Lay of Lethian cannot be said to have been abandoned. A version of the Tale of Beren and Lúthien, albeit far from complete, was marked Fragment of a Fuller Form of the Jest of Beren and Lúthien, told as a separate tale. In terms of its status as a text, we could consider this fuller form as one of the underlying originals of the Quenta, perhaps part of the Golden Book, a consideration that could also apply to the Lays. The non-completion of the end of Doriath and the tale of Orendil remained a problem. As regards the geographical situation, after the great battle, the northern regions of the Western world were rent asunder, and there is still a great building of ships upon the great isles, which in the destruction of the northern world were fashions of ancient Beleriand. Not all the Aldali took ship westwards, and some lingered many an age, especially in the Western Isles and land of Lúthien, Britain. We are still with what we might call the standard model of Britain as a remnant of a drowned and broken Beleriand. We are in the tradition of the Quenta Nodorinwa rather than the Fall of Numenor, which still looks like an independent tradition. We may speculate on what the Silmarillion would have consisted of at this time, and Tolkien been encouraged to finish it. Here it goes as follows. Quenta Silmarillion, the Annals of Valinor, the Annals of Beleriand, the Lammas and the various appendices, the Ailud Dindale, the Ambar Katana, the Lay of the Children of Húrin, and the Lay of Lethian. A few words should be said about The Hobbit. Its relation to the overall mythology is complex. Tolkien used his mythology, as it then existed, as background to the tale, with no intention that The Hobbit was itself to be considered part of it or an extension to that mythology. But in order to isolate the mythology proper from the story of Bilbo, mythology and story had to be separated by vast ages of time. Thus the glimpses of that mythology, the strange stories from the beginning of history, the wars of the evil goblins and elves and the first men in the north, or the account of the unnamed Thingol's dealings with dwarves having taken place in ancient days, place it in the remote past. Since no reference to the drowning of Beleriand or the land of Lethian was needed, Tolkien had a free hand in constructing maps for Bilbo's adventure. None of this would have been of any consequence for the mythology were it not for the sequel to The Hobbit. This grew to be very much part of the mythology, and so retrospectively, The Hobbit, with its historical and geographical frames of reference, had to be fitted in with profound consequences for the mythology's framing device. However, when Tolkien submitted Quenta Silmarillion to Allen and Unwin, it was rejected without having been submitted to their reader, so he proceeded with The New Hobbit instead. Towards the end of writing The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien turned back to reconsider various aspects of what have now become the background of that great work. The third text, The Fall of Numenor, is thought to belong to a period quite early in the writing of The Lord of the Rings, although revisions were made in about 1945-46. The time that the Notion Club papers came into being. This version no longer has Alessia destroyed and omits the passage about Sauron's subsequent defeat in Middle-earth. It is not considered a text for the same reasons as applies to the previous version. Roughly contemporary with the drowning of Ainur Dune, also an account of the fall of Numenor, but this is told from a different standpoint using unfamiliar names. A note of several years later states that the drowning of Ainur Dune represents the Manish tradition, the fall of Numenor, the Elvish tradition, and later the Akalabet, the mixed Duniandic tradition. In a draft letter of late 1948, Tolkien referred to the drowning of Anadune as a man's version of the fall of Numenor, one, moreover, set in a round world. The Elvish myths are flat world, a pity really, but it's all too integral to change, since both the fall and the drowning were, in effect, merged into the Akalabeth. Nothing more will be said of their contextual status until we consider the last named work. In the drowning, the world is said to be round, even before the cataclysm, although this is presumably intended as a reflection of the ignorance of men who wrote the book. Tolkien was soon to take seriously the wider cosmological difficulties implied by the concept of a flat world. The Notion Club papers of 1945-46 cannot form past the Silmarillion texts, but it reveals Tolkien's thought concerning the relationship of his mythology to history. Discussions between Frankly and Jeremy hinted a way in which the past, as recalled by myth and legend, might have a reality of its own, distinct from the true past. To Frankly's, "But that doesn't make such things as Arthurian romances real in the same way as true past events are real," Jeremy responds, "I didn't say it in the same way. There are secondary planes or degrees." Jeremy later remarks that the distinction between history and myth might be meaningless outside the earth. "I think it might at least get a great deal less sharp on the earth further back. Perhaps the Atlantis catastrophe was the dividing line. Different pasts in secondary planes or degrees can exist, and the line where one mythical past and the real past converged was the fall of Atlantis, Numenor." Now, when, for the sake of brevity, I have abridged the final section of the essay. Here, Node explains at length Tolkien's issues with in-universe transmission via Elfwine, Pengelod, and Brumil, and the implications that would have for aspects of the Silmarillion constituting Mannish, Elven, English history and mythology, as have already been elucidated. A framing device which finally eluded him, and of course we are left without one in Christopher Tolkien's iteration of the Silmarillion, though this is consistent with Tolkien's own developments towards the end. Also here, Node goes over Tolkien's issues with cosmology, his attempt to reconcile and later modify his original flat earth with the scientific fact that the earth has always been round. The implications here for Node concern the verisimilitude of Middle-earth as having actually existed, yet on the flip side, a round earth implies a realistic sense of scale, reducing the earth's cosmic significance, and with it the narrative significance of the Valar. Node also suggests a potential solution via the Notion Club papers. Node summarizes his points and his conclusion, which I'll read in its entirety at the end. In about 1951, Tolkien started to work on the Quintus Silmarillion again, with a good deal of elaboration and remoulding of the existing material, but no advance in source and origination over that of 1937. It consists of the Quenta, the Annals of Valinor, and the Annals of Beleriand. Also in 1951, Tolkien started a revision of the Old Fall of Gondolin. We may regard this as one of the texts behind the Quenta. Tolkien here achieved one of his finest prose pieces. It is heartbreaking that it was never completed. The story of Meglin was begun about this time, although revised at about 1970, in view of the unfinished revision of the Fall of Gondolin. It is interesting to see that Tolkien added a note to the 1970 version to the effect that it was to be inserted in the Fall of Gondolin in its place. Thus, of Meglin is intended to be as part of the other unfinished text. Tolkien's long letter to Milton Waldman is of interest here. Of a special note are his thoughts on the ordering of the parts of his mythology. The cycle begins with the music of the Ainur. It moves then swiftly to the history of the elves, or the Silmarillion proper. The Silmarillion is the history of the war of the exiled elves against the enemy. Several tales of victory and tragedy are caught up in it, but it ends with catastrophe and the passing of the ancient world, the world of the long first age. The chief of the stories is the story of Beren and Lúthien, the elf maiden. There are other stories almost equally full in treatment and equally independent, at length to the general history. The children of Húrin, the tragic tale of Túrin Túrinbar and his sister Niniel, the fall of Gondolin, and the tale or tales of Elendil, the wanderer. The three main themes of the second age are dealt with analytically, and in tales or accounts, the rings of power and the downfall of Numenor. At this time, then, the Silmarillion perhaps is composed of the Quenta, the Silmarillion proper, together with the Ainul Lindale, but with longer independent accounts of Beren and Lúthien, the children of Húrin, The Fall of Gondolin, and of Elendil the Wanderer. The story of Beren and Lúthien has both a prose form and a poetic form. The Children of Húrin existed in old alliterative verse form, but Tolkien was moving to the long prose form. The Fall of Gondolin has its uncompleted revision. The most extended account of Elendil appears to be Bilbo's poem at Rivendell. The two accounts related to Numenor and the Rings of Power are noted, though this was not necessarily intended to be a complete listing of everything that was to go into the Silmarillion. Nothing is said about any framing device or about the geographical historical relation of Britain to any of this. It may be useful to look at how Tolkien understood the textual status of The Lord of the Rings at the time it was published. It is presented as a new selection from the Red Book of Westmarch, The Hobbit being the previous selection. Thus, what is really a straightforward narrative becomes an extract from altogether new textual source, the Red Book, which can surely not be ascribed to Elfwine. Since the Third Age of Middle-earth is now long past, the shape of all lands has been changed, but hobbits still linger where they live, the northwest of the Old World, east of the sea. The Akalabeth is mentioned as being held among the records of Gondor and records of the downfall of Numenor, while the Silmarillion tells the tale of the Silmarilli. The Third Age is now long past, and although there is no mention of Lethian or Elfwine, it is notable that reference is made to the Akalabeth, a text that Tolkien had only recently made, and their references to Pungolod implicitly in Elfwine. The original version of the tale of years of the Third Age indicates a vast amount of time between the age and our own time, the afterworld. It is said that Eldarion should rule a great realm, and that it should endure for 100 generations of men after him. Given this in his initial sketch for the Tale of Years of the Second Age, Tolkien estimated that an age should last approximately 3,000 years, which could be understood as corresponding to 100 generations of men. He seems to be saying here that the new realm endured for a whole age, until a new age brought again new things, and perhaps that there was another age beyond that, before we come to our own time, for the editor of the Tale of Years of the Third Age says that even the chronicles of the House of Elessar are lost. The Tale of Years, originally written to go with the later annals of Valinor and the annals of Beleriand, appears to have been a summary of the dates and entries in those works, adding nothing to them. At the same time, the annals of Aman and the Grey Annals, the Tale of Years was the subject of further work, resulting in a clear manuscript at least to begin. Quenna on Ortomio, the author, up until the passing of Fingolfin's people to Middle-earth, follow glimpses of events of the final parts of the Elder Days, and supplementing the Grey Annals, where that falls short, but with nothing further on the ruin of Beleriand. Here something should be said concerning Narni Chir Hurin. This long prose version of The Children of Húrin took up much of Tolkien's time and effort during the 1950s, but never attained a finished form. It was begun in 1951 and worked on at various times later in the 1950s. There is extensive manuscript material. Christopher Tolkien refers to the vast assemblage of the Narn papers and the vast unfinished work of the Saga of Turin that engaged him in the 1950s. Part of these papers have seen publication in the Silmarillion, Unfinished Tales, and the War of the Jewels. Tolkien returned to the Quenta Silmarillion in the late 1950s. Associated with this new work are two new texts. The first is the splitting off of what had been once the first chapter of the Quenta of the Valar into a separate text, the Valar Quenta, which must, like the Anno Lindale, have the same textual status as the Quenta. The other is to do with the extraordinary matter of Finwë and Mirya. In 1958, revisions little further in the 1958 revisions, little further work seems to have been done on the annals, because they had already gone a good way towards becoming narrative prose, sometimes almost exactly the same prose as in the Quenta. It may be that Tolkien was considering abandoning the annals as such, using what was there as a sort of constituent draft text of the Silmarillion as a single work. Since the Tale of Years did not so degenerate, it could be that Tolkien was considering using the text as a sole vehicle for the purely analytic summary of the events in the First Age, as was the Tale of Years of the Second and Third Ages in The Lord of the Rings, and leaving the existing annals uncompleted. It is difficult to come to a conclusion, as it is arguable that Tolkien's use of the existing annals in this manner did not necessarily mean that he did not hope someday to come back to them and restore them to their epitomizing form, but he never did. Here, the text of the film really end, and Node focuses on the peripheral material relating only tangentially to the Silmarillion, which I've cut again for the sake of brevity. For all intents and purposes, that is the end of his constructive work on the Silmarillion. In the very earliest form of the mythology, was presented as a collection of tales gathered by Ariel that he was told in the elvish isle of Tol Odessia. This isle is later dragged back to the great lands for the faring forth of the elves and becomes Lutany, or Britain. Ariel, who has gained the immortality of the elves by drinking limpe, sees the final outcome of this venture. His golden book tells the full history. In order to avoid difficulties of chronology, this was revised into a scheme whereby Britain and Odessia are quite different. Elfwine, Ariel renamed, becomes an 11th century, later 10th century Englishman, who somehow reaches Tol Odessia in the west. There he is told the tales of the elves' history, which he recalls and brings home. All this has been set in a small, flat world. In the 1930s, Tolkien organized the cosmology of the tales in the Ambar Katana. The late 1930s saw the introduction of Numenor, significant for two reasons. First, because it introduced the concept of a transition from a flat to a round world. Second, because it implied that there was a good deal of unrecorded history between the era of the elvish myths and our own known history. Numenor was not immediately incorporated into the Silmarillion, as it then stood, which constituted to reflect the standard model. However, the changes in cosmology and history introduced by Numenor, by the Numenor material, may have reflected the first stirrings of doubt about the standard Ambar Katana model of the world in which the myths were set, that there was a flat world in a miniature universe, whereas we, who are supposed to accept the myths as is, in some sense a true history, live on a round world in an unimaginably vast universe. These doubts seem to have exacerbated during the compositions of The Lord of the Rings, begun as a sequel to The Hobbit, which had not been intended as part of the mythology, although it used the mythology as a background. Now that Lord of the Rings has become the story of the passing away of the Elder World, the immediate consequences was a great extension of the historical framework. The first age for the Silmarillion, the second age for the rise and downfall of Numenor, the third age for the post-Numenorean kingdoms, and the final re-emergence of Sauron, servant of Morgoth, culminating in the quest of Frodo the Ringbearer from the fourth age, on as the Age of Men, which must eventually turn into known history. One consequence is that the island of Lethian or Britain, as the remnant of shattered Beleriand, has ceased to have a meaningful role. It plainly does not lie off the shores of a second or third age Middle-earth, unpeopled and unhistoried. Now it can only emerge as a separate entity in some future evolution of the lands of the northwest of Middle-earth, as can Europe as a whole. This tends to loosen the English mythological connection. About the time Tolkien became exercised about the cosmological setting of the world, and I think it was more a matter of overall scale that concerned him than the flatness of the world, these considerations led him to new alternative models, one essentially that of the modern astronomical universe with a round Earth from the beginning, the other something of a compromise universe, apparently consisting of what is pretty much the old Ambar Katana world, embedded in a much larger region of innumerable stars, a quasi-astronomical universe at least. The latter seems to be the preferred model for some years, although it is difficult to tell exactly what is being referred to. In so altering his cosmology, Tolkien was faced with a problem. The old stories of his mythology that were tied to the Ambar Katana universe, the star-making activities of the Varda, the origin of the sun and moon from the two trees, and so on, could no longer be true. Since the elves must be supposed to have true astronomical knowledge from the Vala, the old myths could no longer originate with the elves, specifically to Pengalod. Tolkien considered jettisoning the entire Pengalod Elfwine framing device, and instead having the myths told and myths' tales retold by the Numenoreans and their successors, who imposed their own primitive cosmological concepts on the original true elvish histories. Thus the appearances could be preserved by a new form of transmission. This did not happen at once. In several post-Lord of the Rings texts up to about 1958, Elfwine and Pengalod are still the originators or transmitters of the ancient lore, and a good deal of the old mythology could be retained by using the compromise model of a flat world within a larger universe, at least the straight path to the west, something that would not cohere with and always around the world could be kept. Such a world could still just be accommodated within the Pengalord Elfwine tradition, but it would also be in keeping with a purely mannish Numenorean descent for the legends. There is a fair degree of ambiguity about the origins of the Sun and Moon in the post-Lord of the Rings version of the Silmarillion, with the original version of the origin in the Two Trees omitted. In the end, Tolkien came down on the side of the Numenorean model. Having so decided, he needed some scheme of textual transmission for the legends of later times. He had one to hand, the Red Book. Thus Bilbo in Rivendell writes the myths of the Elder Days in the famous three large volumes that, with the memoirs of Bilbo and Frodo together, with a volume of Hobbit genealogies, make up the complete Red Book of Westmarch. Hence the whole mythology finally devolved into the single vehicle of the Red Book. And since this was fixed in print in the second edition of The Lord of the Rings, it can hardly be called into question. With the publication of The History of Middle-earth, it has been possible to gain a detailed understanding of the evolution of the constituent texts of the Silmarillion, as well as the factors that bear on their selection. It has also been possible to gain a good idea both of the state of the Silmarillion papers at the time of Tolkien's death and of the virtually impossible task faced by Christopher Tolkien of editing them into a single volume for publication. What was published consisted of the Quenta Silmarillion, filled out where necessary, and finished with passages from the various annals and narratives, together with the Ainul Lindale, the Valaquenta, supplemented with the Akalabet and of the Rings of Power, which four texts exist in a finished form. All the other textual units that might have been thought suitable for inclusion were, as can now be seen, either in too unfinished a state to find a place, or simply could not have fitted into the book, given the form adopted for its publication. Consideration was given too to a scholarly edition, in which the last version of each section we printed together with a detailed history of its evolution, but fortunately a finished narrative was chosen instead. Fortunately for the simple reason that a scholarly edition at the time would most certainly have precluded later publication of The History of Middle-earth, in which the evolution of the Silmarillion can be traced in a degree and detail that no one could have possibly conceived back with the original publication of Christopher Tolkien's iteration of the Silmarillion in 1977. Right, that's the end of the essay. Moving on from how we considered this, obviously that has set up a lot in terms of considering the overall mythology, the process of the evolving mythology, but also the framing device, and again how Tolkien attempted through the Notion Club papers, through his framing devices, to connect some form of real history. And again, back to Tol Eressëa, the rendering of Beleriand. But of course, as we see with the progression of Tolkien's work, this becomes less effective, essentially. The process begins to decline. Nevertheless, what we're going to discuss next week, in addition to talking about the fundamental elements underpinning the universe, we're going to be assessing all aspects, essentially, of Tolkien's work, which can be interpreted as a mythology or England or not. There are major detractors, as we'll see next week. Other than that, either everyone can suddenly rush and type in a series of flurry of questions. Let me see. I didn't see any super chats. No, we don't have any super chats. So you have me for a couple of seconds before I'm going to leave it for this evening. I know it was quite a heavy article, hence the need for an abridgment. But really detailed in there was everything which needed to be accounted for in terms of understanding the creation of the world, the place, the conception of what Tolkien essentially considers for his work, and also the various iterations and books we're going to be covering. Obviously, we're going to be delving into the vast 12, now 13 volume History of Middle-earth as the bedrock for this piece when we go into the specific chronology. So in 2 weeks' time, we're going to be discussing the Ainul Lindale. My conception as it stands at the moment, and again, because I mentioned this is very much a collaborative process, my current thoughts are essentially beginning with the Ainul Lindale, the making of the world, and taking this back to the flight of the Valar to Valinor. Essentially, that's my provisional feelings on that. So that'll have to wait for 2 weeks. I have got some questions, no super chats, but a couple of questions. Toglas asks, are you pagan or Catholic? Catholic. When did you first read Tolkien? I did in like 1997. Well, I'm not that old, actually. I don't really want to tell you the date without giving away my age, but when was I? How old was I? Probably about 9 when I first read it. I read The Hobbit first, and I was probably about 7 when I first read The Hobbit. Anyway, that seems to be the only couple of questions coming in. So other than that, I'll just flip to here and mention a couple of things. So tomorrow, because again, this is part of the new organization, the new stream structure, which we're going to be pursuing for the rest of the year. So Friday's 9 p.m. is going to be the Lord of the Rings series. And then, of course, we'll replace it later in the year. Saturdays and Monday is going to be the lecture / reading and the discussion portion of our normal podcast, the Apolite podcast, which at the moment encompasses Nations of Charlemagne and Orthodoxy, Autocracy, and Nationality. It should also be noted, if everyone checks out the description, I have created yesterday I created a Discord server. If people want to join and engage more with the work of the channel, they're free to do so. I will, I promise I will be over there and check and interact with you on occasion. I'm very sort of hostile to social media in general, so this is all a rather sort of new experience for me. But if people want to join that, I really want to see an organic community spawn around there, and hopefully, begin to discuss the work of this channel. And maybe, possibly, if we get a good rapport going, we could possibly get a couple of people on the Discord to become guests when we have the various discussions. So that would be potentially interesting. So yes, that is the Discord and the server. Other than that, I have listed the current benefactors of this channel, the current patrons. Thank you so much for all your wonderful contributions to the channel, which help really facilitate this work. As you'll know, I've been investing a lot in books, articles for the various series coming up, including the book I was just reading from, the Tolkien Legendarium, Essays of the History of Middle-earth, and I am investing more time, so I'm directly investing all the shekels you are conferring on me, so thank you very much. I have noted that there are a couple of last minute super chats coming in. As others have said, this is Jackson Hawker for $10. As others have said, thank you for your work, AM. Well, thank you very much. Great White Lobster, good stream friend for your troubles. Thank you very much. And Toklos has sent a £5 super sticker, so thank you very much. I will apologize again. As you can probably tell, I've been ill all year, essentially, and I've been dealing with a very sore throat on this, and unfortunately I think the reading a bit suffered from then. So I do apologize profusely for that, if the reading wasn't as coherent and I was struggling a bit with my my voice. Hopefully it'll be better tomorrow, but we'll see. Anyway, I'm a soldier on. So other than that, thank you all very much for watching. Do remember to like and leave a comment. It really helps. Thank you very much. If not, share, or obviously if you're not subscribed already, please do subscribe. Thank you very much again, and I will see you tomorrow at the same time. Good night.